Okay, chapter 20. David is going to cross the river. Since you were here, David ran from Absalom. Absalom gets killed by Joab, even over David told him not to. David is now coming back to Jerusalem. He's still on that side of the Jordan. And Judah comes up to meet him, and they're going to bring him across. Then Israel, the 10 northern tribes, when I say Israel, comes down, and everybody's there. Yippee! David settles a lot of business last week. He does it with political savvy that is just incredible. Like I said, I always compare it to Vito Corleone and The Godfather. Just, it's business. Even people he's mad at, he does the thing that will keep the kingdom strong. You know, even if, you know, it's business. So even if this guy try to hurt me, then if it's to a political advantage, then I'll just let it go. And his constant problem with the tribe of Benjamin, it keeps bringing its, you know, you will start to notice, if you haven't noticed by now, that it's constantly a problem between David and the tribe of Benjamin, because Saul is from Benjamin. And David is now the king. It's not one of Saul's kids. So they've lost their political clout. They're not happy about it. So at this crossing, Israel becomes mad with Judah, because Judah helped David across the river. With all the things that are wrong in the world, it's these little things that are seen, and it's seen as a slight. It's seen as having the king's ear. Now, the south will be, you know, they're a little worried because David's from Judah, you know, and so when they see this, they all get mad, and they're going to leave. And they're storming off, and David hasn't even made it back to Jerusalem. It just never stops. Now, at this point, this is where we're at, and it says, now a worthless fellow happened to be there whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. So once again, it's the same tribe. And he blew the trumpet and said, we have no portion in David, nor do we have an inheritance in the son of Jesse, which is David. Every man to his tents, O Israel. That's his way of saying, let's get out of here. And he makes a public announcement. Everybody hears it. He makes it loud enough for the king to hear it. And when, 10 tribes of the 12 are now heading back home. And so all the men of Israel withdrew from following David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to their king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem, which really isn't that far. But they travel with them. Then David came to his house in Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, the concubines whom he had left to keep house, and placed them under guard and provided them with sustenance, but he did not go into them, so they were shut up until the days of their death, living as widows. These are the 10 concubines that David left behind to take care of the castle and take care of the palace and family business. There was no threat to leaving them, nobody's going to kill, but if you will remember, Absalom went up to the roof, pitched a tent, and had sex with all 10 of them to basically say, I'm the king. David, by law, Absalom by law couldn't do that. That is forbidden under law. And David knows he can't do it. So, you know, he can't have relations with him again because his son did. So, basically, these women didn't do anything wrong anywhere. But now they're never going to have children. They're just basically, this says it plainly, they lived as widows. He took care of them. But as far as any clout, it's all over. So nothing good happens to these ladies. Then the king said to Amasa, call out the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself. If you remember, Amasa was the guy who David put in charge of the army over Joab. Amasa was Absalom's general. So to form a bond back with Judah, he chooses him to two purposes. He chooses him to be his general so that Judah will say, oh, he chose our guy to be the general, and to put Joab in his place because Joab just killed his son after he told him not to. So he says to him, we have a problem. Get the army together and be back here in 3 days, you and the army. Well, that didn't work. So Amasa went to call out the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which he had been appointed him. Now, I'm not sure how much longer. I'm not sure what happened. We just know that he didn't show up when he was supposed to with the people. This is his first job as general. And David said to Abishai, Now, Abishai is the number two man. If you will remember, Abishai is Joab's brother. Abishai has been with them the whole time. Now, Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, so that he does not find for himself fortified cities and escape from our sights. It's not sure here whether or not he just gets so mad at Amasa that he just says, okay, you go do it. Or if Amasa's finally headed out and he wants him to go also. My feeling on this, the way it's written, is that he's not too happy with Amasa. And he says, you know what, you go get this, because he's not here yet. So then the name of Joab shows up, because Joab's with his brother. And there are always men that follow Joab. I mean, David's the king, but Joab's their general, regardless of what David does. So Joab went out after him, along with the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men, and they went from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now, these are the heavy hitters. Joab and the mighty men, the mighty men is a certain group of men that had been named before. These are the guys who just always solve the problems. And the two other groups are David's bodyguards. These are the best of the best. These are the Navy SEALs. I don't know how else to put this. These are the best that there is to offer. So that's how important this is. I want it done now, and I want the best. What he doesn't need is this festering up north. This guy running around and getting a bunch and making a war out of this. So the best possible men are heading north to stop this. And these are all men of Judah, basically, that are heading up into Israel. The best way to think of this is just consider if the United States had always remained north and south. You know, the Civil War. It was still configured under a president, but there was north and there was south. And just figure an army from the south coming up into the north to get somebody, how that would be viewed. It could be problematic. When they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, I love that. I love this stuff. Go over to the large stone, and everybody read that, went, oh, the large stone. Amasa came to meet him. Now, Abishai, Joab, and Amasa all meet at the big rock. And now Joab was dressed in his military attire, and over it with a belt with a sword, and his sheath fastened at its waist, and he went forward and fell out. Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, brother?" Gives him a friendly greeting. And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand, so he struck him in the belly with it and poured out his inward parts on the ground, and did not strike him again, and he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Joab just kills him. I mean, he just, in a sneaky, underhanded way, is in a friendly greeting. You know, the assumption is here he purposely dropped his sword so that he wouldn't have to draw it. And so he drops his sword and he picks it up with his hand. And he goes, hey, and he wants to give, and while he does that, he runs him through. There really isn't any sign of animosity here or anything else other than he took Joab's place. Other than the fact that Joab had a fight against him. Well, and Joab, don't forget this stuff, when he was Absalom's general. So this is the third person that Joab has killed that he was not supposed to kill. There was Abner, there was Absalom, and then there's Amasa. Joab is a problem. He's just doing what he wants to do. And now there stood by him one of Joab's young men, and he said, whoever favors Joab and whoever's for David, let him follow Joab. This is an enormous moment. David's not even here, and David's future is being decided. The entire army is up there. The guy who the king put in charge has just been murdered by the guy that was in charge, and they're all standing there looking at each other with this dead guy on the road. And the army that was with Amasa is just going, whoa. And they're trying to figure out what to do. And fate hangs in the balance here. And this young man, one of Joab's guys, said, hey, everybody, and he pulls in David's name. He says, if you're for David, follow Joab. Where he got that from, I don't know, but it might work. But Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the middle of the highway. If you're going to lay there in blood, you might as well wallow. And when the man saw that the people stood still, so he says that, and nobody does nothing. And we're talking armies. I mean, you know, and they're all looking at each other, Joab's guys and Amasa's guys. I mean, this could turn into a war right here just between Judah. They haven't even made it on their job yet. And he then it says, when the man saw that the people stood still, he removed Amasa from the highway into the field and threw a garment over him. And when he saw that everyone who came by him stood still. So as soon as he removed from the highway, all the men passed on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. So what he does, he just drags him off the road, throws a sheet over him, everybody goes, eh. And they all follow Joab. And history has changed. And he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel, even Beth-Makkah, and all the Barites, and they gathered together also and went after him. This is big news. So what it says is after he drags them off the road and they all join up, they go up into Israel, and Israel joins them. This is big stuff. I mean, this could have went either way. Israel could have said, you're not coming up here and taking our guy, you know. And they actually joined in. And they came and besieged him at Abel Beth-Makkah, and they cast up a siege ramp against the city, and it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. So this giant army outside of the city, they're putting a siege up, they're building a rampart to get up over the thing. And then it says, and I can't tell you how many times between the book of Judges, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, a woman comes up and just fixes everything. You know, you got all these warriors out there pounding on their chest, throwing spears, and this woman's, and it says, a wise woman called from the city. Hear, hear, please tell Joab, come here that I may speak with you. She yells over the wall. Hey, tell Joab, come here. And so he approached her and said to the woman, and the woman said to her, are you Joab? And he answered, I am. And she said to him, listen to the words of your maidservant. And he answered, I'm listening. And she spoke, saying, formerly they used to say, they will surely ask advice at Abel. And thus it ended the dispute. I am of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You are seeking to destroy a city, even a mother of Israel. Why do you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? Apparently she's saying, why are you doing this? Nobody, like, I don't know if anybody ever showed up and said, hey, we're here for this guy. They built this entire rampart and they're sieging the city. And a woman goes, does anybody know why we're in trouble? What did we do? And everybody goes, and she goes, let me ask. And, you know, and she's, and what she's saying is, and it's pretty cool. She goes, I will surely have ask advice at Abel. And it says, what she says, we're pretty smart up here. We can figure stuff out. People come to us for advice. Why don't you tell me what's wrong? See if I can fix it. You know, the rough way of putting it, but yeah. Joab replies, far be it for me that I should swallow up or destroy. Such is not the case. And what he's saying is, you know, I really don't want to destroy your city. You know, that's not what I'm here for. I don't. She says the inheritance of Israel, well, that's their town. It's what God gave her. You're destroying what God gave us. And she invokes the Lord. And he says, well, I don't want to do that. And he says, but a man from the hill country of Ephraim. That phrase is used as often as Benjamite for David. The hill country of Ephraim and Benjamin have just been, well, they're pretty much the same place. It's just trouble for him his entire life. Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has lifted up his hand against the king David. Only hand him over, and I will depart from the city. And the woman said to Joab, well, this is easy, she says. Behold, his head will be thrown over to you over the wall. She goes, that's what this is all about? We can fix this. You know, and the woman wisely came to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they were dispersed from the city, each to his tent. Joab also returned to Jerusalem. I can't help it. Every time I have a mental picture of somebody yelling over a wall, I see Monty Python. I know I said that before. I see Monty Python and the Holy Grail and the Frenchman up on the wall going, go away or I shall taunt you some more. And that's just what I see. And I just see a head flying over the wall, you know, and I just go, okay, thanks. And we're out. Things were different. You know, things were, this is a rough time, and it's mean. You know, we wonder, and a lot of times we can't grasp the fundamentalist Muslims. We can't grasp their level of violence. You know, I've seen videos of them stoning young girls to death and standing around and cheering and stuff. But I I asked you, you know, we are 600 years older than the Muslims as far as Christianity. What were we doing 600 years ago? You know, inquisitions, we were burning people, we were stoning people, we were drowning people, we were fighting wars because of these obscure little belief differences. I mean, we were just killing each other over, and you go, that's not a whole lot different than what I hear right now. We're just older. And, you know, I sit back, and this always brings it to my mind, where they're throwing heads over the wall and go, and everybody's happy. Whereas, you know, if that hit YouTube now, this would be like just this, you know, outrage, you know, look, a head flying over the wall. But to them, it was just like, okay, let's go home. And everybody's happy. It's just, there is very little separating us from this. Very little. The right set of circumstances, we get primal fast. You really do. It says, now Joab, now this is a slight little statement, but this is huge. Now Joab was over the whole army of Israel. This is just settling issues. And Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Chariites and the Peleites. Remember, they were separate. The whole army and these two groups were foreigners that were David's bodyguards. The reason they were foreigners is because they kept out of the political intrigue. They weren't associated with anybody. Hence, they could be, you know, when politics is so bad that you have to get outsiders to come in to be loyal, that's how bad it is. Because if you had anybody from Benjamin area, you'd always have to worry, were they going to kill you? So what it's saying is there's the entire army who Joab's over, and then this Benaniah is over this bodyguard group of foreigners, which are very valiant men. And then it goes on to tell us just some more political stuff. Adoram was over the forced labor, which was conquered people who, you know, basically slaves. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Elihud, was the recorder, and Sheva the scribe. Zadok and Abiathar were the priests. That didn't change. What they're doing is David came back to Jerusalem. He changed some things up. He shook it up a bit. The Joab thing, he didn't have a choice. Joab comes back with the army, man, and the army's behind him. When he comes back to Jerusalem, there's the army. He killed the other guy. He doesn't have much choice. And what I want to do is I also want to make a point that we started last week that Roland and I talked about. David is getting old. He's 65 years old now. You know, I'm 53. And 65 years of living the life he lived, war, battle, fighting, man, you start to hurt. I mean, all those little things start to add up, you know. Every time you get hit, every time you, you know, it just wears you down. And you figure he had a 40-year reign. He was 30 when he became king, and he's 70 when he dies. So he's got 5 years left. And this is wearing on him physically. I mean, he is becoming old and tired and weary just from fighting his entire... I mean, when he was a kid, he was out wrestling bears like Davy Crockett, but really doing it, you know, bears and lions. And it just went from there into war. He has never not been at war. And that will just wear you down. You know, if you look at football players, you know, if you remember what happened to Mike Webster and how he ended up, you know, God bless him. You know how it took a toll on him. I can't remember Otto, the center from the Raiders, from way back from the 70s.
Jim Otto.
Yeah, Jim. He was just, he couldn't walk. You know, and that's what this kind of life this was. I mean, this was all out. This wasn't war like where you sit in Texas and you look at the screen and fly the Predator drone and push a button and people die. This is war where you got to stick up when I beat somebody to death with it. You know, and they're trying to beat you to death with it. And this many years of this is a long time. Now, directly after that, and it, actually the time frame for this, this is like a caveat. While this, it's not saying directly, in this general time period, this occurs. Now, there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the presence of the Lord. And the Lord said, it is for Saul and his bloody house because he put the Gibeonites to death. Does anybody remember or know who the Gibeonites are? This is from the book of Joshua, and I'm gonna read it. It's worth reading. The Gibeonites, I want you to think about this, were 400 years ago, what they're talking about, what we're going to talk about. 400 years before this, when Joshua was working his way up through in the Promised Land after Jericho and Ai, he is crushing everybody. He picked up the sword, went in the Promised Land, and he is cleaning house. That was 400 years ago. He has an encounter with the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites were a powerful people, but they were really smart. And they deceived Joshua, and there was a vow made. Now, let's put 400 years in perspective. So what would that be now? 1612? 400 years ago? Okay. Pocahontas. Shakespeare's writing Henry VIII. God remembered the vows that were made 400 years ago. And they know, because it is part of their culture, and every one of those vows that is made is in the book, and the book goes with them. And they know that vow's there, and I'm going to read the vow. But think about something that John Smith did with Pocahontas and made a vow, and all of a sudden we have famine for 3 years, and God said, it's because John Smith made a vow with Pocahontas, and you guys broke it. Well, we broke every vow we ever made with the Indians, didn't we? You know, I mean, every time we made a promise to them, did we break it? I mean, but this is God's people. And he said, you are a separate people. I will not treat you like I treat everybody else. I will give you everything I have, but I will demand everything back. How important vows are when his people make them. He heard it. He took it seriously. Let me just read this before I move back to Joshua. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. The Gibeonites are called three different things. They're called Amorites and they're all called Hivites. Depends, but they're all the same people. It's like saying you're from Pittsburgh, but you're from Squirrel Hill. You know, a Squirrel Hillian instead of a Pittsburghian. But it's all basically the same people. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not sons of Israel, but the remnants of the Amorites. The sons of Israel made a covenant with them, but Saul had sought to kill them in the zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. Okay, it doesn't tell us what he did. It doesn't give us any explanation of what Saul actually. Saul is dead and gone, and we think to ourselves, well, why didn't God bring this up when Saul was here? God brings it up when he wants to. So 3 years of famine hit the country. And what's interesting is it takes 3 years for David to go, maybe I should ask God why there's a famine. And the asking of God, it says, sought the Lord. That's when he would go to the prophet, probably to Nathan. The same one that said, is it you? It's you. And Nathan would talk to the Lord. Often there would be, all through scriptures, there's casting of lots. You know, when people say, man may cast the die, but God determines the outcome. That's not talking about going to Vegas and God let you win. I mean, I heard people say that, you know. It's up to God whether I win. I talked about this week about chance and money, you know, that, yeah, it's still part of life. Unless you think that God's rigging the lottery every day on the daily number for this set of people. I mean, if you have to believe that to believe there's not chance. That every day God's pulling the numbers out of the, you know, for Pennsylvania daily lottery. But anyway, I'm just going to go right to Joshua. And this is what this is all about. This is from Joshua 9, and it goes a little bit into Joshua 10. Now it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan, in the hill country and the lowlands on the coast of the great sea towards Lebanon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, remember those guys are David's guards now? The Hivites, which is our people, and the Jebusites heard of it. In other words, what he's saying, all of Israel. From the Great Sea, which is where the Philistines are, all the way over to the far... When they say the other side of the Jordan, they always mean the east side, you know, crossing over. Unless you're on the east side, then I guess the other side's the west side. They gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and Israel. So what they're saying is all these indigenous people, who generally fought amongst themselves, said, uh-oh, you know, these guys are clearing house. Let's get together and fight them. So all of Palestine gathers together to face Joshua. Moses is dead. Joshua's leading, and he's bringing the people up. And Jericho has fallen, and he's had some impressive victories. It says, when the inhabitants of Gibeon, the people that we're talking about now, which is just a little bit north of Jerusalem, northwest, heard that Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they acted craftily and set out as envoys and took worn-out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins worn-out and torn and mended, and worn-out and patched sandals on their feet and worn-out clothes on themselves. And all the bread of their provisions was dry and had become crumbs. So what they did is they said, go talk to Joshua, but here's what we're going to do. Because Joshua's order is kill everybody. That was the order. Leave no one alive. Go through there and kill everybody. God is not happy with them. God says why he wants them killed, because of their sin. This is God doing two things. He's given Israel land, and he's executing his vengeance on the people who were sacrificing children and all the... God tells them why. And God says, if you go in and do it, I will do the same thing to you. What he's saying to them, he actually said to them one time, it's not because you're better, it's because they're so bad. It's not because you're so specially good. And God actually says that at one point in here. Don't be deceived here. You're not getting this because you're so good. You're going in there and doing this because they're so bad. And I want you to do it. And there's always that, this really, that moment where Jesus says to Peter, put away your sword, changes all of this. There is nothing in Scripture until then that really says that this idea of killing people for God has, for us that sounds so foreign, but man, we were doing this all the way up through the Inquisitions. We were killing people for God, much like we wonder how the Muslims can do this now, but we've been doing this for a long time. It's when Jesus said, put away your sword. I don't need you to fight. And even when he said, when they were going to kill the woman caught in adultery, and he said, go and sin no more. Everything changed. When you read this stuff, think about those moments and how big they were, how much it meant when he said, put away your sword. I don't need you to kill people for me. Okay. So what they did is they're afraid of Israel. So what they say is, we're going to act like we're an envoy that's not from Canaan, that's not from the Promised Land, that we came from over here. But so put on, get World War II clothes like you've traveled for weeks. Your bread's all stale. So this is really brilliant. And it says, they went to Joshua to the camp of Gilgal, and they said to him and to the men of Israel, we have come from a far country. Now therefore, make a covenant with us. In other words, let's get a treaty of peace, is the best way for to look at this. But covenant means you're swearing to God. The men of Israel said to the Hivites, perhaps you are living within our land. These are no stupid people. How do we know you're not from here? And he says, where was I? Joshua, okay, so the men of Israel said, perhaps you should be coming with you. And he said, but they said to Joshua, we're your servants. We didn't come here to fight you. The first thought would be, they're here to spies, or they're trying to get a military advantage. He goes, no, that's not what we're looking for. We understand you're more powerful than us. We will be subservient. And it says, then Joshua said to them, who are you and where did you come from? I need to know who exactly you are. And they said to him, your servants have come from a very far country because of the fame of the Lord your God, for we have heard reports of him and what he did in Egypt. See, they knew. All of Canaan knew what happened in Egypt. Everybody knew what happened in Egypt when they left, in the sea and the plagues, and everybody knows this. And so what he's doing, he's telling Joshua a truth that he already knows, and he's sort of getting on his good side. And all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon king of Heshbon and Og king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. These are people that Joshua had defeated. So our elders and all the inhabitants of the country spoke to us, saying, take provisions in your hand for the journey and go meet them and say to them, we are your servants and make a covenant with us. This is our bread It was warm when we took it from our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. Now behold, it is dry and become crumbs. These wineskins which were filled were new, and behold, they are torn. And these are clothes and sandals are worn out because of the very long journey we were on. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for counsel from the Lord. So they fed them. And without asking God, which has always been a huge mistake before you make a major, major move on a political front, every time, if you will remember how mad God got at Saul for doing this, for not seeking the Lord. And it said, Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. And it came about at the end of 3 days after they had a covenant with them, they heard that they were their neighbors and they were living within their land. Now the sons of Israel set out and came to their city on the third day. So they go, they saddle up and go to Gibeon. And now their cities were Gibeon, Shephrah, Beeroth, and Kiriath Jearim. So they're spread out in four cities, but they're known as Gibeonites, and this is kind of cool. The sons of Israel did not strike them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord of Israel. And the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. Now, why would they be grumbling? Because that's their land. They can't kick the people off the land because that was the land that was their inheritance. And not only that, they would have the plunder. So what this is saying is, okay, now there's this part of the promised land that you can't plunder. And the people aren't happy about this because realize they've been kicking butt since they left Egypt. They're on a roll. I mean, they are just wiping everybody out there and they don't want to stop. And they're saying, we can't. And it's a nice place. And they're saying, we have to let them go. But all the leaders said to the whole congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and we cannot touch them. This we will do to them, even let them live so that the wrath will not be upon us. Listen, so that the wrath will not be upon us for the oath which we swore to them. That's the wrath that shows up 400 years later because Saul took it upon himself. You know what? I'm tired of these Gibeonites. I'm going to kill them. And God remembered, as he always does. The leader said to them, let them live, so they will become ewers of wood and draws of water for the whole congregation, just as the leaders had spoken. In other words, we'll make them servants. Then Joshua called for them and spoke to them, saying, You have deceived us, saying, we are far from you when you were living in our land. Now, therefore, you are cursed. You shall never cease being slaves, both ewers of woods and draws of the water of our house, my God. So they answered Joshua and said, because it is a certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servants Moses to give you all the land. They know. They knew. They knew what God told Moses. These people know who God is. I mean, this isn't just, you know what I mean? And to destroy all the inhabitants of the land, which they've realized that's us. And therefore, we fear greatly for our lives because you have done this thing. Now, behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right to you in our sight. In other words, going, oh, well, we're not apologizing. We're alive. Everybody else is dead. And thus he did to them and delivered them from the hands of the sons of Israel, and they did not kill them. Joshua made them that day ewers of wood and draws of water for the congregation, for the altar of the Lord to this day, the place which he chose. Now, I want to read a little further because just to get an understanding of what kind of power we're talking about here, in chapter 10 it says, and now came about when Edion Zedek, king of Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is still in heathen hands, heard that Joshua had captured Ai and utterly destroyed it, just as he had done to Jericho and its king, so he had done to Ai and its king, that the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were within their land. So this other big king down in Jerusalem goes, wait a minute, Gibeon made peace with Israel and they're staying? So now he's worried that Gibeon is now becoming an ally. Why does this matter? Because it says that he feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all of its men were mighty. These weren't punks. This got him scared when Gibeon said, we're not going to fight with David. Whoa, that was horrid news because Gibeon was the thumper. they were the, you know, this is where all the warriors were. And they were smart enough to say, we can't beat them. Yeah. We cannot beat these guys. We can't win. And so this gets this king set up, and it goes on to where there's a war. They come up against Gibeon because they figure, well, what we're going to do is we're going to attack Gibeon because they made an alliance with Israel. So we will just make them weaker. And Joshua comes to their aid and saves them and wipes these people out. 400 years later, we sit here. And we're almost done. It said, thus David said to the... We're 400 years later. And like I said, put 400 years in perspective. I mean, really think about 400 years, what all's happened. And the best way for this is think of Shakespeare writing Henry VIII. That's how long ago this was. Okay. David says to the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? So he calls them in and he says, how can I make atonement for you that may bless the inheritance of the Lord? So what he's saying, the inheritance of the Lord is the Jews. So what he's saying is, how can I make things right with you so that we get blessed? Is what he's saying. I know that we're in famine because we treated you bad. So he says to them, what do you want? The Gibeonites said to him, we have no concern for silver or for gold or for Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel. In other words, we don't have the power to do that. And he said, David said, I will do whatever you say. They said to the king, the man who consumed us and planned to exterminate us from remaining within the borders of Israel. This gives you some idea of the severity of what Saul was doing. Extermination. I mean, this is just so they don't exist anymore. And that's the only real thing we have telling us how bad it was. And he said to him, let seven of his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, I will give them. So what they say is, we want seven of Saul's descendants, male descendants, and we want to hang them. And Dave says, okay. But the king spared Mephibosheth. Remember, Mephibosheth is Jonathan's son, the crippled kid. The son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the oath the Lord made, which was made between them, between David and Saul's son, Jonathan. David made a covenant with Jonathan. He also made one with Saul about taking care of the families. So the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, Armion and Mephibosheth, not the same Mephibosheth, a different one, who she had born to Saul. So these are two of Saul's sons through a concubine. And five sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, these are Saul's grandsons, whom she had born to Adriel, the son of Barzillai. This isn't the same old man that was at the crossing who said, you know, I don't need to go over with you. I'm old. Just let me die with my family. That's the same name, but it's not the same guy. Because this guy isn't from Gilead. And then he gave them to the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the mountain before the Lord, so that the seven of them fell together, and they were put to death in the first day of the harvest at the beginning of the barley harvest. I guess that's symbolic that they did it on that day, because, that's still part of their culture, the appeasing God and the harvest, because they're in a famine. This is like an offering as far as they're concerned. Israel has nothing to do with this, but from my understanding, this is how the Gibeonites are seeing this. You know, they're seeing as a sacrifice to God. And Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on a rock from the beginning of the harvest until it rained on them from the sky. And she allowed neither the birds of the sky to rest on them or the beasts of the field by night. So, see, Israel isn't allowed to leave people hanging out. They need to be buried. So what this woman does is she goes and she just, these seven rotting... I don't know if you've ever smelt a dead person. There is nothing that smells like a dead person. Deer, nothing. I mean, it's just bad. I mean, it is. I can remember going into a DOA that had been dead for months, and my clothes smelled when I went home just from being in the house. Mm-hmm. You know, you could still smell the rancid. You know, you have to take a shower, wash your clothes. You could smell it on the street when the door was open. It's just that bad. And this woman stayed there for quite some time, just not allowing anybody. Well, her sons are there, and her, I guess that would be her nephews, are just, and she just won't let anything pick at them. And she just, and it's kind of cool. And when When it was told to David that Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, the concubine of Saul, had done, then David just does the right thing. He mans up. He settles the matter. Then David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh-Gilead. If you'll remember, when Jonathan died and Saul died in battles with the Philistines, that is, they hung him up. And these guys from Jabesh-Gilead, under threat of death, because Israel had been defeated, went and took their bodies down, stole them away, and buried them at the most convenient place, at their place, because they knew, we can't do this. It's wrong, you know. They could have been killed for doing that. Who had stolen them from the open square of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines struck down Saul in Gilboa. And he brought up the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from there. And they gathered all the bones who had been hanged. David gets Saul, gets Jonathan, gets Saul's two sons, gets Saul's five grandsons, puts them all together. And they buried the bones of Jonathan and Saul, his son, in the country of Benjamin in Zeal, which is where he was from, where Saul was from, in the grave of Kish's father. Thus they did that king commanded, and after that God was moved by the prayer for the land. When that was done, the famine ended. And we'll finish there. I'll pick up on verse 15 when we pick back up. Let's pray.